You are listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Evan Osnos lived in China from 2005 to 2013 as the Beijing bureau chief for the Washington Post and then as the China correspondent for the New Yorker. Over that time, he reported on the country's changing landscape and the profound social and economic shifts happening there. In his new book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth and Faith in the New China, he looks at the relationship between the all-powerful Communist Party and the growth of individualism and personal wealth. It is published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux, and I'm very pleased to welcome Evan Osnos to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Now, you first went to China in 1996. Why'd you go then? What for?
I think I had a similar experience to a lot of Americans who had a conventional public school education. I'd really never been exposed to China before I got to college. And I got to college in 1994 and went into a class on Chinese politics, and it was a revelation. It was this incredible tale. And I realized pretty quickly that if I really wanted to get involved in China studies and to understand this place, I had to learn the language.
And it had already changed by 1994 from just a few years before and continues to change.
Yeah, and that's addictive in a funny way. I mean, those of us, I think, who have spent a lot of time in China and go back get used to the idea that when you're there 6 months after your last visit that you can reasonably expect total transformation.
So how much had changed by the time you got to China in 2005 when you were going to live there?
Well, I'll give you an example. In 1996, when I lived there as a student, the economy at the time was smaller than that of Italy. And the nicest building in town, the place where you went in Beijing when you really wanted to splurge, was a hotel called the Jianghua Hotel. And it was, as the architect described it very proudly, it was a perfect replica of a Holiday Inn that he had seen in Palo Alto, California. So then I come back in 2005, 9 years later, and China is building, by some measures, 80% of the skyscrapers under construction in the world. And the city had gone vertical.
And you write that the way the word for ambition, yexin, was used had changed.
Yeah, that was one of the things that drew me to this subject, which is that the word itself, ambition, historically had been a pejorative in Chinese. If you were accused of being ambitious, that was counter to Confucianism. It was certainly counter to socialism. And it could really damage your career. And it has transformed. And now if you go on Amazon.cn, if you go buy books in Chinese, what you'll find is that in the self-help aisles, there are books that say things like how to be ambitious.
Had the Chinese government used that Confucian idea of conformity to keep people in line?
It's always been a useful political instrument in a sense. You know, you can tell people that we are Chinese, we are different, and therefore we're not part of the kind of what they describe as universal values.
Along with the rise of the individual came the rise of entrepreneurs. Can you tell us about Gong Heinan?
Yeah.
And how she came to start an online dating service?
Yeah, she's an extraordinary story. I met her when she was just out of graduate school, and she had grown up in a farming family in a little tiny town. Her parents couldn't read or write. And she, of course, like a lot of people in her generation, she's about my age. She was in her late 30s at that point. She had gone to the city, gotten an education. And what she realized, of course, was that there was no way for her to find a mate. There was no way for her to meet the people she wanted to meet.
Well, aren't arranged marriages the norm, or weren't they the norm in China?
Right, exactly. And her parents had met through an arranged marriage because they shared a political background.
But that didn't happen in her case?
No, that's one of the things that's changed. You know, the defining fact of this time is that choices that used to be made for you are now in your own hands.
So she went to an online dating site, and what happened?
She was unsatisfied by what she found. She said, this isn't good. The technology could be better. And so she said, I'm going to start one.
Well, they were ripping her off, weren't they?
Yeah, she paid her $50 at the time, which was a lot of money, and she was given a set of dates. And when she started calling these guys up, she realized that they were fakes. They didn't exist. They were composites. A photo had been put with some sort of generic ID information. She said, we can do better. And it turned out there was a huge market.
But when she complained, what did they tell her?
They said, it's your problem. And they said, and this is a quote, they said, take a look at yourself, and you're going for these grade A quality men. And, you know, this really wounded her personally, but also
they were telling her she was ugly.
They were telling her she was ugly. They were telling her that they said, look, you should know what kind of guy you're going to attract. And she, I think this offended her on an intellectual level, too, because she said, my generation is not subject to these kinds of forces in a way that our predecessors were. And so she started a website where people could send in their personal information, even before actually it was very easy to do that. They would send it in by post in some cases.
Where did she get the money?
She started to track. First of all, like a lot of bootstrap entrepreneurs, she used some of her own money that she'd accumulated in odd jobs. She attracted a couple of very small investments. Then one of the people who she helped find a mate for turned out to be wealthy, and he gave her her next chunk of cash, and eventually she got venture capital funding.
And did she find a husband for herself?
She did. She found a husband online who was a researcher of fruit flies.
She also became an advice columnist. What kinds of questions do people ask her?
People would ask her things like, if my mother-in-law wants me to stay at home and produce babies, and I don't think I want to do that, what should I do? And her advice was very often iconoclastic, and she was sort of rebelling against many of the received ideas that are very important to what a Chinese family is. So she would say, look, that's not for your mother-in-law to decide. You need to get some courage and go tell her you're not going to do that.
Sounds very Western.
Well, she wouldn't see it as Western. And one of the things that's interesting about her is that she doesn't really speak very much English. She's not Westernized in any way. I've been to her house, and she sees herself very much as a Chinese person, but a modern, contemporary Chinese person. And that's important because that's the way China's becoming.
My guest is Evan Asnos, and his book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Is divorce becoming more common in China?
It is, yeah. And this follows the trajectory in most industrialized countries that eventually divorce rate climbs. And that's happening. And but it's also the marriage rate remains unusually high in China compared to other places.
But China has been going through this incredible transition. People have been migrating from the countryside to the big cities. And I would think that would be putting an awful lot of stress on families in general and also on marriages.
That's right. This is the kind of private drama that we don't usually hear about, and it's hard to see from far away, but is very present when you're living in China and you see it up close, is that the things that really dominate people's conversations are the things that dominate conversations anywhere. It's the intimate stuff about your life. It's how your relationship is with your parents and your kids. So that is, for me, actually, once you can cut through the kind of mystification that often surrounds China, you find that there is a lot about the day-to-day life that is familiar to us.
Would I find Gong Hainan's online dating site to be similar to one that I would find here?
The difference is that people are even more specific about what it is they want. You know, for thousands of years, basically, you were just paired up with somebody in the village. And now that there's this sense of choice, people will say, well, I want somebody, for instance, who's had at least two ex-boyfriends, but not more than four. And I want to say no Virgos, no Capricorns, and they have to be over 152 centimeters tall. There's this incredible specificity. It's like people have embraced this choice.
Now that more people are moving out of poverty and there are a lot of very wealthy people in China, is there a lot of conspicuous spending there?
There is, and you can, for instance, in Beijing where I lived, you could go down the street and there'd be a Lamborghini dealership on the left-hand side. And then at the same time, and then there'd be some, fancy luxury goods vendor on the right-hand side.
Mostly Western products?
Mostly Western brands. And in the last few years, you've also seen an interesting evolution, which is that for a while, people wanted the most ostentatious thing they could get, because that was obviously a signifier of what you'd had achieved and you'd come from poverty. And now people have decided, well, they're moving sort of rapidly through the experience and they want something more subtle.
Well, how does this work in a communist country? The party was once very much against class distinctions. Everybody wore that same Mao jacket, at least the men. Now there are many rich people in China. In fact, it's my sense from this book, rags to riches is a favorite scenario.
And this is, you're right, and this is one of the real political puzzles that they face in the years ahead, which is after China today is ruled by the Chinese Communist Party, and it still believes fundamentally, or it purports, it holds fast to these ideas about an egalitarian society. But the reality that everybody lives is it's a place that, in fact, has a larger gap in between rich and poor than you would find, for instance, between New York and Ghana.
Well, how can you call yourself communist while you're encouraging a capitalist economy?
What they say is that they have socialism with Chinese characteristics, And that is a euphemism that is designed to be vague. It allows them to allow the conditions on the ground to change, and yet they don't also have to change the political system.
I once met an exchange student who was studying business at NYU who told me that he had been caught up in the Cultural Revolution when he was young, and his disillusionment after had led him to never trust government again. All he wanted to do was get rich.
You do see – it's an interesting observation, because what you see now is that over the last generation, people have seen that the kind of creed, the socialist idea that was so essential to how they lived, that no longer has any relationship to their lives, and the only people they can depend on are themselves. And that is atomizing, and that's one of the really remarkable things about this time, and an uncertain thing. People don't know if they – there's a lot about the individualized life that is gratifying, but it's also – it's a little bit disorienting.
Does it help to be a party member, perhaps in government, if you want to get rich?
Yeah, it certainly does. And it operates a little bit like a professional society in some ways. You know, it exposes you to contacts, gives you business opportunities. But, you know, I have young Chinese friends who joined the party when they were in college because their professors said, you know, we have to meet the quota this month. Would you join the party? In other cases, they joined because it was a pathway to professional success or government power. But it's been uncoupled. It's sort of been unfastened from the ideology that used to be at the center of the party experience.
Has an interest in English and Western practices and American education come with this new wealth?
Yeah, it has. I write about a program called Crazy English, which was for a long time the most popular English language study program in China. And people devoted themselves to it in a way that I think to those of us in the West would look even more intense than a language study. It really was almost like a religious experience for people.
Thomas Piketty has talked about what happens when there's a growing income gap, and he sees this as a danger for Western economies, especially the American economy. What about the Chinese economy, where this is also happening at a very fast rate?
It is a danger. And oddly enough, you know, the Communist Party would be one of the first to acknowledge that they've gotten themselves into a situation where the gap between rich and poor is now broader than it is in many countries. And they don't have an obvious pathway out of this.
Well, has it caused social upheaval, political pressure?
It has. It's in China today,
there's no Occupy movement.
You can't have an Occupy movement. But the thing that might surprise people to hear is that on a day-to-day basis in China, there are hundreds of political demonstrations all over the country. On an average year, there's 180,000, meaning 500 a day. And these are demonstrations for all kinds of reasons. For instance, environmental pollution or an act of perceived injustice.
Are people punished for participating?
They are. Yeah. If you're the leader of a movement, then that's a very, very risky thing to do. But people don't feel that they have other options, and so they take to the streets.
You write that with the opening up of China, the ambivalence in the Chinese view of the West didn't go away. It deepened, in fact. Why? How did the Chinese see the West?
You know, if you're Chinese today, you have a very complicated feeling about the West. There are parts of it that are, of course, very satisfying. And China has bought into much of the pop culture that the United States exports around the world.
And they watch American movies.
They watch American movies. You know, The Big Bang Theory was a very popular TV show until recently when it was removed from the web. And yet at the same time, people are above all enormously proud of being Chinese and what that civilization has contributed to the world, as they should be. And so these two ideas don't always coexist very comfortably.
But because now there are more people with money, there's more travel outside of China to the West.
And that's been amazing to watch.
And you went on a tour with
them. I did, yeah. I signed up for a tour of Europe with Chinese tourists, and we went across 10 countries, 5 countries in 10 days on a bus. And to see the outside world through their eyes was really amazing. You know, one of the things we did was that, and this was sort of a surprise, but it turns out you can cross Europe and eat only Chinese food. And I was struggling to understand that for a while, and then I remembered, of course, but that's what we as Americans have done too. I mean, we've gone in search of hamburgers in Paris for decades, and I can understand the impulse.
Your tour stopped in Trier, Germany to see the birthplace of Karl Marx. Did anyone talk about what Marx might have thought about the current Chinese system?
No, actually. They looked at Marx with a kind of remote sense of dutiful admiration. They said, this is somebody who is important to our history. But I stood with one of the older members of the group, and we were looking up at this bust of Marx's head on the wall, and he sort of laughed, and he said, you know, the young kids in China today don't know anything about this guy. And he was a guy who had come up from nothing and had made, in effect, a capitalist fortune.
What kinds of things did your Chinese tour guide and the others on the tour say about the European way of life and how it compared to the Chinese way?
Well, I'll tell you, the thing that they admired most and the thing that they commented on over and over was the education system that is available in the West. They marveled at the idea that a student, a teenager, for instance, could say to their parents, you know, this is what I want to study in my freshman year of college, and that the parents wouldn't have the final say. And they spoke of that very admiringly. There's a lot of ways in which Chinese parents today are trying to emulate the best elements of American education. On the other hand, they also looked at the European economy, and they looked at it and said, well, you know, frankly, of course it's not doing so well. It seems like everybody's sitting around drinking coffee all day long.
They thought that German workers were lazy.
Yeah, they couldn't understand why people would be striking to work less.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he served as the China correspondent from 2008 to 2013. His book, Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Evan Osnos, a staff writer at The New Yorker. He served as its China correspondent from 2008 to 2013. He's the winner of two Overseas Press Club Awards, the Asia Society's Osborne Elliott Prize for Excellence in Journalism on Asia. And he's written a book called Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. How is the Internet controlled in China?
The government is very suspicious of the Internet, and it has built perhaps history's largest infrastructure to try to limit human expression. And they've done it remarkably effectively in the sense that, you know, there are people who are all over the country whose job is to read the web and take down comments that are damaging, for instance, that are critical of the government. And yet at the same time, it's remarkable how much gets through. People are very creative about how to figure out ways to do it.
People also could figure out what to trust when they read something in a newspaper or read it on the web?
Yeah, this is what's been so, I think, transformative about the Internet in China, is that it's created an alternative source of information. It used to be there was only the state media. You know, you could pick up the paper or you could watch TV. And people were not naive. They knew that this was, on some level, there was propaganda. But now it's up to them to decide.
What about political conversations on Renan, the Chinese version of Facebook?
Yeah, there is this very lively political conversation that's going on all the time. And people are very opinionated. And you can be surprised, in fact, when you go on the Chinese web and you see this really passionate, often very critical debate. You think, well, how is it that a Communist Party allows this to happen? And that's partly because they make a distinction between people who are saying critical things and people who are actively organizing. And they'll let you get away with a lot more as long as you're not trying to organize.
Well, why did they ban Facebook? I understand now they're reconsidering that position.
My own sense is that it'll be tough for Facebook to really get back in there, because I think they took a look at what happened in the Middle East in the Arab Spring. And that is, in so many obvious ways, a nightmare scenario for the Chinese leadership. They look at it and they think, well, if it could happen to Mubarak, who was so installed so deeply into Egyptian life, well, then it could happen to anyone.
They must also be following the NSA story.
They are, and they followed it with some satisfaction. You know, they've looked at the discovery that Americans are being monitored by their government in ways they didn't understand before, and they thought, well, see, now this buys us credibility.
Well, for many Americans, that came as a big surprise. What about the Chinese public? Are they aware of how much the government knows about them and how much it censors?
Yeah, they are aware of it. They assume in many ways that the government has full knowledge of what it is that they're doing. And that creates a suspicious – I mean, China's not the first country, authoritarian country, to have experienced what happens between neighbors, for instance, when you no longer feel that you can trust the people around you. It's a corrosive effect, and people talk about it. It's a low-trust society.
How does the Great Firewall work? Who's in charge of it?
Well, there is a organization called the Central Propaganda Department in China. And the Central Propaganda Department is the highest ranking agency in charge of monitoring thought work.
Didn't it almost disappear after Tiananmen Square?
It did, yeah. They after Tiananmen Square, which of course was this demonstration movement by young people in 1989. And from the government's perspective, that was a failure of propaganda. They had failed to properly educate their young, as they saw it. And they said, well, maybe we need to get rid of the whole approach and start with something else. And Deng Xiaoping, in fact, the leader at the time, was the one who said, no, we're not going to get rid of propaganda. In fact, we're going to double down on it, and we're going to reinvest and make it more sophisticated and modern.
And they use Walter Lippmann, the American columnist, as a role model?
Yeah, this was something that I came upon in the research and really surprised me, that when they were looking for inspiration for how to go about being modern propagandists, they looked, after all, to the homeland of public relations. They looked to the United States, and they were impressed by the way that Walter Lippmann had figured out how images, for instance, could be a powerful way to speak to the American public. And they also looked at Coca-Cola, and they said, well, now look, if Coca-Cola – and they said this in Chinese – these are in some of the party textbooks. They say, well, if Coca-Cola can figure out how to sell this product to its people, well, then we can sell our product to its people.
And does the propaganda work?
It does work. It works in a deep way, in the sense that people are fundamentally shaped in a way. But I don't think that's unique to China. In some ways, we are all subject to the embedded beliefs in our media systems. But I do think that one of the things that has created an unintended effect is that the young generation in China is very skeptical of information because they've been raised to believe that what they see in the newspaper is not going to match what they see on the internet and is not going to match what they see in their own lives.
You write about a vast and evolving list of words that must and must not appear in the news.
Yeah.
Words like...
words, for instance, like Tiananmen Square, if you're using it in the context of the demonstrations. Even the date, for instance, of that movement, which was June 4th, Liu Si in Chinese, you can't put that on the Chinese internet. In fact, it's the restrictions are so rigid that when a company, a technology company, for instance, updated its software and it became software version 6.4, the same as the date, June 4th, it actually became a problem. They couldn't download their software in China.
What happens when a journalist disobeys the party's rules?
It's very dangerous to be a journalist in China, a Chinese journalist. And you can be prosecuted, for instance, on the basis of the words that you write. There's a charge called incitement to subversion, which is what was used, for instance, against Liu Xiaobo, who is the Nobel Peace Prize winner, who's now serving a term. And on a more day-to-day basis, you have to be very self-aware, and you have to decide – frankly, it's self-censorship, and that's what they describe it as. They have to decide what they can and what they can't dare to publish.
And what happens if you're caught accessing censored material?
That is one of the areas in which the government has allowed people more of a private sphere of autonomy, because what they've decided is as long as you're not acting on it, you know, if you're sitting at home and reading Patrick Henry, well, then all the power to you. But if you decide to then weaponize that information and take it and form a movement, then they come down on you very swiftly.
In the past, China had a lot of anti-Western propaganda. Do you still find it?
No, it's gotten harder.
No,
it's a
running
harder case
dogs
to make.
American capitalism?
Well, it's changed. I mean, what there is now is you're no longer running dogs of capitalism because, frankly, China is one of the most successful capitalist cultures on the planet. But what you can be is trying to import quote-unquote Western values into China, and that's become a hugely dangerous idea. If you're accused of doing that, and a lot of people have been, then you're perceived as trying to foment a kind of ideological insurrection of a certain kind.
Well, right now, China is engaged in another kind of war of words, but with its neighbors, Japan, Vietnam, all of the countries that are in the South China Sea or,
that's right,
or near, who may be vying for all of the oil reserves that are there.
Yeah, China has had over the course of the last few years a growing set of conflicts on its borders with Vietnam, the Philippines, Japan, and part of this is about China deciding that the time to lay low in foreign affairs is over. They say, look, we're the world's second largest economy. We're on our way to being a superpower. It's time for us to build the kind of security atmosphere that we expect in our neighborhood.
Well, isn't this kind of like what we're seeing with Russia and eastern Ukraine? People, you know, it's one thing to condemn what these countries are doing. It's another thing to say, well, we're going to fight you. Vietnam is not going to go to war with China.
No, they don't want to. Though I can tell you that there is a lot of concern in Asia that the possibility that one of these conflicts could lead to a small-scale war, a shooting war, because what you have is a lot of vessels that are now sailing in among each other all the time, and there's a possibility for miscalculation.
Sometimes journalists do seem to get away with things. You write about Hu Shul.
Yeah. Yeah,
Hu Shul Li.
Exactly, yeah.
She, her magazine reported on what happened in the aftermath of the 2008 earthquake in Sichuan province, one that the government was very embarrassed about.
Yeah, Hu Shul Li is a fascinating figure, and I met her right around the time that there had been this terrible earthquake, and one of the legacies of that was that there had been 5,000 children who died in schools that collapsed because their school construction had been poor. For instance, there had been corruption, and people had substituted materials for cheaper materials. And her magazine, which was called Cai Jing, figured out a way to write about that in a way that was deeply informative and investigative, but just inside the line of what was possible.
So what constitutes crossing the line? You mentioned Liu Xiaobo, the literary critic, university lecturer, who called for a change in China's one-party system. He's won the Nobel Prize.
That's right, yeah.
But he's in prison. We have Ai Weiwei, the artist, one of the most important artists internationally, and not just because of his political positions. He also lives under house arrest. There's the blind Chinese lawyer and activist Chen Wanchen, who escaped house arrest in China and wound up coming to New York, and that was a big scandal.
Yeah, this is a struggle for any intellectual in China today, is how far can you push it before you run the risk of losing the ability to express yourself at all? And people are becoming bolder all the time. Ai Weiwei, for instance, the artist you mentioned, is a very good case of it, because in 2005, 2006, 2007, he was just beginning to become political and to figure out, well, look, there are issues that I care about in this society that, for instance, justice in the courts. He wanted to see that if somebody takes a case to court, that it'll be adjudicated fairly. It began to bother him, and eventually he got accustomed to the idea of skepticism and the idea of expressing it publicly, and it was very hard for him to keep his mouth shut. In fact, he's kind of constitutionally incapable of keeping his mouth shut, and I say this knowing him pretty well.
And that's led him to do all sorts of things outside of China which have embarrassed the Chinese, major art exhibits that have been critical of his country.
You know, I think it's an interesting question to ask. What was the thing that pushed him over the line? What was the moment when he stopped being an acceptable critic? And for a long time, people said, Ai Weiwei will never get in trouble because he's too famous. They don't want to lock up somebody who's so famous. And then he ended up spending about 3 months in custody and has been unable to leave the country ever since. And I think the answer is that it was probably not a single act. It was probably a recognition or a decision on the part of a certain part of the government that this was somebody who was heading in a direction that was in confrontation with us.
I've always wondered why the Chinese government seems to be so threatened by Falun Gong.
You know, this goes back to Chinese history, in which religious movements in which people are willing to sacrifice and devote themselves to things larger than the government, have destabilized the government. And this was a fact of the 19th century and before. And the Chinese government is acutely aware of its own history. And what happened in 1999 was that the Falun Gong organized a protest movement that surprised the party. They managed to surround, actually, the leadership compound. It was a peaceful protest, but the effect was that the party realized we don't actually understand how large and how potentially powerful this organization is, and therefore we're going to eliminate it.
You write about a high-speed rail crash in 2012, and the story is about more than just an accident. It's about the speed with which China is building railroads, and it's about massive corruption. How are projects like new highways, bridges, and high-speed railroads lining people's pockets?
Well, this is the thing that in some ways reminded me of our own experience in America. You know, China right now is going through this enormous infrastructure development that's a lot like the American story of the second half of the 19th century. We built the Transcontinental Railroad, for instance. And China has laid down more high-speed railway than the rest of the world combined. And it's been a huge boon for people, for the public. And yet at the same time, it has also been an enormous source of corruption. I wrote about a guy, for instance, who was the minister of railways, who managed to steal so much money they ended up going to prison. But to put it in perspective, his brother actually stole so much money that the cash was piling up in his home. And
I love the names. Great Leap Liu.
Yeah, yeah. His nickname was Great Leap Liu because, and in some ways, you know, he really was a visionary. He did imagine that there was a possibility for China to have this world-leading infrastructure. The only problem was that the political system was not designed to keep an eye on his baser instincts, and so he followed them as far as they would take him.
But then the government had to deal with it and put a spin on the story.
Yeah, this railway crash really was, in many ways, I think, a clarifying moment for members of the new Chinese middle class, because they've been beneficiaries so much of the system. But they've also realized, by looking at the way in which this train system had been built, with there were errors. And as a result, people died.
Well, how does the government write about things like adulterated milk that kills children?
Yeah, there was a case a few years ago in which there was a milk company that was allowing chemicals to be added to, for instance, infant formula in order to make it look like it had more protein than it did. And that seems like an obscure case. But in fact, in China, and particularly for the strivers and the success stories in China, this was just an absolutely galling crisis, because what it meant was that the people who were supposed to be protecting us from venal behavior, you know, the big companies, the reputable companies, and of course the local officials who are in charge of regulating them, that they had failed them. And that was, for a lot of people, you still hear about it now. Even 6 years after that scandal, people talk to you about the fact that that infant formula scandal was a turning point for them.
So they learned about it, even though there isn't a free press.
They learned about it. Initially, the local censorship authorities had prevented it from being publicized because they wanted to wait until the Olympics were over. They didn't want negative publicity. And then eventually it made its way into the papers. And what people say to them, what people say now is, if you had allowed that to be publicized when the reporters discovered it, you might have saved lives. And they really haven't forgiven the authorities for that.
Have corruption and bribery and kickbacks always been a part of the communist system, or is this something that became more obvious after Mao died?
Well, this is the thing that's important to recognize, is it's not just been part of the Chinese communist experience. It goes way back before them. I mean, and it's not unique to China,
well,
right?
Chiang Kai-shek called corrupt.
Right, exactly. I mean, this has been, and it's, I think, important to recognize that fact, because in so many ways, you know, this is the great paradox of the Chinese experience, is that the Chinese Communist Party, despite, you know, in the face of all the predictions, has actually improved people's lives in so many measurable ways. And yet it has also allowed the flourishing of a culture of corruption that in the end is threatening its survival.
Well, every once in a while there is a campaign to root out corruption and get rid of officials who are corrupt. But from my reading of the New York Times and your articles, it's my sense that this is really more of a political thing. You want to get rid of somebody, you say he was corrupt, and it's likely he was.
I think it's been used as a bit of a political weapon. That's true. I also think there is a recognition at the highest levels of the party that they had a problem, an image problem. It had become, you know, day to day, people in the neighborhoods were saying the party is enriching itself, and they had to address that. And that's why the current president, Xi Jinping, has launched probably the largest corruption campaign in the last 30 years. But the thing is that it doesn't reach into the sort of minor rhythms of life. People don't yet feel that the system is clean.
Well, it looks like things are slowing down. There was that incredible growth.
Yeah.
And have they kind of reached a limit?
This is a debate we see every day now. And I think there are credible arguments on both sides. Some people say China's on the verge of a crisis. I think the larger issue is that the growth model that worked so well for 30 years, 40 years in fact, has exhausted itself. And so China is facing the need to reinvent its economy from being basically an assembly line economy to being a knowledge-led economy. And in order to do that, you have to make deep, deep changes, and that takes time.
Did your time in China change the way you see this country?
It did in some ways. I think, you know, being away as an American clarifies what you see about your own country. And it's funny, moving to Washington, D.C., where I live now, I realized that the difference in the political culture, among the differences, is that in Beijing, you always knew that what you read in the paper should be treated skeptically. And in the U.S., you're seeing competing point of views, and you have to decide which ones to treat skeptically.
Evan Osnos's book is Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. It's published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. Thank you so much for being on our show. There's something that you're going to be involved with very soon. You'll be speaking with Orville Schell tomorrow night at 6:30 at the Asia Society. Then Thursday at 8 a.m.? speaking at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs on East 64th Street. For more information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org, where you can find out about that and some other appearances as well, one on June 3rd.
Yeah, I'll be back in New York on June 3rd at the National Committee on U.S.-China Relations.
Thank you so much for coming by today.
Thank you for having me.